Hey everybody, I'm back home now. I was not able to post this episode previously because of technical difficulties in the last couple months there in Iraq and in Kuwait as well. So this episode was recorded entirely in Iraq, except for this introduction here. And I will post it, well, I'm posting it now for all of you guys. And just let you know that I'm still around, and I will be putting together another podcast soon. Just taking a little break with the family and playing Xbox with my 10-year-old a lot. But in keeping with tradition, I'm recording this after midnight, and I will post it probably around 1:30 or so. So I guess that's about all I have to say about it. Enjoy.
The anti-Bush press makes terrorist.
Their interests are not your interests. Their truth is not your truth. The corporations have their media. Now we have ours. The Progressive Podcast Network. Now we are the media. Listen to your media. Take your country back. Go to ProgressivePodcastNetwork.org. The Progressive Podcast Network. ProgressivePodcastNetwork.org.
Oh yeah, it's action time! Welcome once again, folks, to the podcast that all of you know and love, Watch It Burn. This will be my final episode in this incarnation. I definitely plan on keeping this going after I get home. And possibly,
smooth jazz.
I'm really tired. But going to possibly have the wife involved in a new incarnation under probably a different name, because, I don't know, something that would encompass both of us there. So, in the meantime, sit back, listen, and enjoy this final episode in this form of Watch It Burn! Yeah! Some audio from Tom Hartman that really illustrates why I feel that the mission I am carrying on with this podcast is so vitally important, and why so many of us in the progressive community are doing what we do. It's pretty much because we have to, because we see paths of history being retraced that will lead to just a horrific, horrific disaster for the Earth if we do not.
February 27th, it started when the government, in the midst of an economic crisis, received reports of an imminent terrorist attack. A foreign ideologue had launched feeble attacks on a few famous buildings, but the media largely ignored his relatively small efforts. The intelligence services knew, however, that the odds were he would eventually succeed. The warnings of investigators were ignored at the highest levels, in part because the government was distracted. The man who claimed to be the nation's leader had not been elected by a majority vote, and the majority of citizens claimed he had no right to the powers he coveted. He was a simpleton, some said, a cartoon character of a man who saw things in black and white terms and didn't have the intellect to understand the subtleties of running a nation in a complex and internationalist world. His coarse use of language, reflecting his political roots in a southernmost state, and his simplistic and often inflammatory nationalist rhetoric offended the aristocrats, foreign leaders, and the well-educated elite in the government and media. As a young man, he joined a secret society with an occult-sounding name and a bizarre initiation ritual that involved skulls and human bones. Nevertheless, he knew that the terrorist was going to strike, although he didn't know where or when, and he had already considered his response. when an aide brought him word that the nation's most prestigious building was on fire. He verified it was the terrorist who had struck, the terrorist who he had been warned was going to strike, and then rushed to the scene and called a press conference. "We are now witnessing the beginning of a great epoch in history," Adolf Hitler proclaimed, standing in front of the burned-out Reichstag-Gebouw parliament building surrounded by national media. "This fire," he said, his voice trembling with emotion, "is the beginning. It is a sign from God." He used it to declare an all-out war on terrorism and its ideological sponsors, a people, he said, who traced their origins to the Middle East and found motivation for their evil deeds in their religion. 2 weeks later, the first detention center for terrorists was built in Oranienburg to hold the first suspected allies of Marius van der Lubbe, the infamous terrorist. In a national outburst of patriotism, the leader's flag was everywhere, even printed large in newspapers suitable for window display. Within 4 weeks of the terrorist attack, the nation's now popular leader had pushed through legislation in the name of combating terrorism and fighting the philosophy he said spawned it, that suspended constitutional guarantees of free speech, privacy, and habeas corpus. Police could now intercept mail, wiretap phones. Suspected terrorists could be imprisoned without specific charges and without access to their lawyers. Police could sneak into people's homes without warrants if the cases involved terrorism. To get his patriotic, quote, decree on the protection of people and state, end quote, passed over the objections of concerned legislators, he put a 4-year sunset provision on it. Immediately after passage of the anti-terrorism attack, his federal police agencies stepped up their program of arresting suspicious persons and holding them without access to lawyers or courts. In the first year, only a few hundred were interred, and those who objected were largely ignored by the mainstream press, which was afraid to offend and thus lose access to a leader with such high popularity ratings. Citizens who protested the leader in public, and there were many, quickly found themselves confronting the newly empowered police's batons, gas, and jail cells, or fenced off in protest zones, safely out of the earshot of the leader's public speeches. 45 minutes past the hour. Within the first months after that terrorist attack, at the suggestion of a political advisor, Adolf Hitler, this is just our history lesson for the day, Adolf Hitler brought a formerly obscure word into common usage. He wanted to stir a racial pride among his countrymen. So instead of referring to the nation by its name, or as the fatherland, as it had often been called, he began to refer to it as the homeland, a phrase publicly promoted in the introduction to a 1934 speech by Rudolf Hess. Rudolf Hess said, "Dank Ihr Führern," Dank, thank you, Ihren, your, Führern, leadership, thanks to your leadership. The homeland is here. Heimat, Hussein. The Deutschland will become the Heimat, the homeland, for all the Germans in the world, for alles Deutsche über die ganze Welt, as I recall. Well, actually, here it is.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt. Alle Hitler!
As hoped, people's hearts swelled with pride, and the beginning of an us-versus-them mentality was sown. Our land was the homeland, citizens thought. All others were simply foreign lands. We were the true people, he suggested, the only ones worthy of our nation's concern. Bombs fall on others, or human rights are violated in other nations, and it makes our lives better? It's of little concern to us. Playing on this new implicitly racial nationalism and exploiting a disagreement with the French over his increasing militarism, he argued that any international body that didn't act first and foremost in the best interest of his own nation was neither relevant nor useful, and thus withdrew his country from the League of Nations in October 1933 to negotiate a separate naval armaments agreement with Anthony Eden of the United Kingdom to create a worldwide military ruling elite with the UK. His propaganda minister orchestrated a campaign to ensure the people that he was a deeply religious man and that his motivations were rooted in Christianity. He even proclaimed the need for a revival of the Christian faith across his nation, what he called a new Christianity. Every man in his rapidly growing army wore a belt buckle that declared, Gott mit uns, God is with us. And most of them fervently believed it was true. And now to the caller's note. Within a year of the terrorist attack, the nation's leader determined that the various local police and federal agencies around the nation were lacking the clear communication and overall coordination necessary to deal with the terrorist threat facing the nation, particularly those citizens who were of Middle Eastern ancestry and thus probably terrorist and communist sympathizers and various troublesome intellectuals and liberals. He proposed a single new agency to protect the security of the homeland, consolidating the actions of dozens of previously independent police, border, and investigative agencies under a single central leader and department. Most Americans remember Hitler's Office for the Security of the Homeland, the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, and its Schutzstaffel, simply by its most famous agency's initials, the SS. And es tut mir leid für mein schlecht Deutsch, for those who speak German. His assistant, who dealt with the press, noted that since the terrorist attack, radio and press are at our disposal. Those voices questioning the legitimacy of their nation's leader in the face of this new Department of Homeland Security. Those who were raising questions about his checkered past were now fading from the public's recollection as his central security office began advertising a program encouraging people to phone in tips about suspicious neighbors. To consolidate his power, he concluded the government alone wasn't enough. He reached out to industry and forged an alliance, bringing former executives of the nation's largest corporations, millionaires and billionaires, into high government positions. A flood of government money poured into corporate coffers to fight the war against the Middle Eastern ancestry terrorists lurking within the homeland and to prepare for wars overseas. He encouraged large corporations friendly to him to acquire media outlets and other industrial concerns across the nation, particularly those previously owned by these suspicious Middle Eastern people. He built powerful alliances with industry. One corporate ally got the lucrative contract worth millions to build the first large-scale detention center for enemies of the state. Soon more would follow. Industry flourished. He reached out to the churches, declaring that the nation had clear Christian roots and that any nation that didn't openly support religion was morally bankrupt. In a speech on April 12th, he said, "My feeling as a Christian points me to my Lord and Savior as a fighter. It points me to the man who once in loneliness, surrounded only by a few followers, was greatest not as a sufferer, but as a fighter. In boundless love as a Christian and as a man, I read through the passage which tells how the Lord at last rose in his might and seized the scourge to drive out of the temple the brood of vipers and adders. As a Christian, I have the duty to be a fighter for truth and justice." End of quote. From Adolf Hitler.
So there you have it. Some very, very frightening parallels indeed. And that is why I do what I do.
Hey Godless, this is Christian in England, and I just thought I'd send you a message from the centre of the English countryside. I'm actually sat on my allotment at the moment, sat under an apple tree. This is the place I listen to a lot of my podcasts, especially yours, and I just wanted to say that your podcast really, really, really kind of hits a nerve with me. Really, that wasn't me, that was a horse. Really educates me as to what's actually going on out there from the ground level up. I find your commentary fascinating. I find everything you talk about really, really interesting for someone out here so far removed. It's very enlightening. Keep it up. I can't wait for your next podcast. Stay safe and take care. And that was a passing car, unlike when I hear your podcast, a jet about to take off. I can't wait for the next one. Good luck, man. Bye-bye.
And that, of course, was Christian from Documentally.com. Go and check out his podcast. He has some very, very interesting guests and topics, and I'm always amazed at the quality of his podcast and just love it. So check him out. I definitely highly recommend him.
What you write, what you left, what you write, what you center, and what you back. Hey!
Play a little audio now for you from some videos that I got from, well, downloaded a couple, got some from a guy here that supplies me with a few interesting videos. This one is from a little flash animation video called Barry Says, and judging by the tags on it, you can get it from knife-party.net, and it's pretty interesting, really clever flash animation, very well done, but here it is.
The United States of America is the most powerful nation on Earth. In itself, this goes a long way to explaining the things it does around the world. At present, it's conducting a war on terror, or more accurately, a campaign against opposition to US domination. Others prefer to call it the beginnings of the Third World War. The United States has an insatiable appetite for conflict. And since going into Korea in the 1950s, it's been at war with someone or other in some corner of the globe, non-stop, right up to the present day. This drive is now led by the weapons manufacturers themselves. It is a highly dangerous precedent. I call it war corporatism. It is the door of a new fascism being pushed open. And don't be fooled, not all fascism looks like Adolf Hitler. The reality, as we see from the Iraqi invasion, is that the presidency has been captured by the most powerful elements of this corporatism. And this ghastly molecule aims to turn the world into its very own enslaved global market. And the plan is well underway. The attack by Al-Qaeda on the World Trade Center is just one response to it. Is this a conspiracy? Quite the opposite. It is a high-profile project known as the Project for the New American Century. People like Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Perle are the major players among politicians, right-wing thinkers, militarists, and industrialists in the creation of the project. The project is a neoconservative manifesto, which includes in its toolbox the unbridled use of war in clearing a path for U.S. interests. The will to attack Iraq came entirely from this visible yet sinister group. September the 11th was merely the pretext. Bush is merely the figurehead. And so, who's next, you wonder? Iran? North Korea? France? Britain? None of us really matter to them.
And here's another interesting one I got that I don't know the original source of.
If you really want to know the truth about the state of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction before the invasion, listen to Colin Powell in February 2001. He states clearly that there was no threat from Saddam Hussein.
He has not developed any significant capability with respect to weapons of mass destruction. He is unable to project conventional power against his neighbors.
And this is Condoleezza Rice, Bush's national security advisor, in July of the same year, saying the same thing, putting the lie to their own propaganda.
We are able to keep arms from him. His military forces have not been rebuilt.
And that, many believe, was the truth, a truth that was covered up and conveniently forgotten after September the 11th, when Bush and Blair decided to attack Iraq.
I got some other videos that were given to me that are pretty decent, though. Like, what do we got here? The movie Why We Fight. I finally got to see that. Really, really interesting. 9/11 in plain sight, P-L-A-N-E, and hijacking catastrophe. I say definitely look those up, and you'll see some really interesting stuff in there, but I'm not sure where you'll find those. I got them from a buddy of mine here, so just go ahead and look them up, and I'm sure you won't have any problem finding them.
Hey, Godless. This is Bill from the Florida Soapbox podcast, your fellow progressive podcaster. Just wanted to call in and let you know how much I have enjoyed your podcast in the last several months. I'm glad to hear you're coming back to the United States. And I hope you enjoyed Iraq. You know, I hope you enjoyed the maddening heat and discomfort. But anyway, glad you're coming back home safe. And just wanted to ask you, though, I haven't seen you.
And that, of course, was my buddy Bill Alvarez from the Florida Soapbox. And judging by the sound of it, he must have just completed recording an episode of his because he sounded a little bit drunk. And Bill, in honor of you, I think that my first episode I do after getting home, I am going to get stinking drunk while I do it, or at least a portion of it. I'll probably do the 10 for 2, you know, the shot of tequila every 10 minutes for 2 hours. But as I said, that was Bill Alvarez from the Florida Soapbox, another member of the Progressive Podcast Network, which you can find at newmediarevolution.org. And check out our forums. It's a pretty interesting discussion forum where you can interact with the members and listeners of the Progressive Podcast Network. And you can find it at newmediarevolutionaries.com. Or there's a link on the newmediarevolution.org site, pretty close to the top there. And so go ahead and check it out. I think you'll really enjoy some of the conversations going on there. We got some lighthearted topics within the forum itself. So enjoy. I know you will. There we go. F minus. Who pays? Who profits? Finally, a song short enough that I could use it in its entirety as a bumper. But that's one of the reasons I love 80s hardcore. It's just nice and short, quick and to the point generally. And on that topic, who pays, who profits, I think it's pretty obvious who's profiting from all of the bullshit that's been going on in the last few years. And who pays for it? We do. Those of us who are not members of the power elite. And it's sad and shameful that, I don't know, so many of us bear the burden and make the sacrifices that make other people rich, when so many of us don't even have the basic necessities like healthcare. And just healthcare is the main one, but any kind of sense of security in the world, when we know that at any moment, you know, our jobs could be shipped overseas, or if we're in a job that can't be shipped overseas, we know that cheap labor will be imported to take our place. And we're seeing that more and more as those in power use their power to allow to enrich themselves and to maintain their power. And I am sick and tired of being a tool for that purpose. And that is why I am not seeking promotion, nor will I seek reenlistment. My principles will not allow me to do that. And on that subject, I had known when we came here during the war, when I was in Kuwait waiting for the invasion to start, I had known that because, unlike too many Americans, I actually had the free time available to watch media other than that within the United States, other than what I have taken to calling the mind control media. because they pretty much do exist to control how we act by controlling how we think, and control how we think by controlling what information we are given. And it is done in such a way that we are only given the information that will allow us to make decisions that will lead to benefits for the corporate masters of that media. So therefore, I think it is entirely fitting to refer to them as the mind control media. Though it might sound paranoid and all that, but, you know, I'd say paranoia is just another word for paying attention in these days. And originally, yes, I had known that this whole adventure was not above board. And I knew it was an illegal order, and yet I went ahead and followed those orders because I did not have the integrity to refuse. And it's all well and good to have your principles and your integrity, but principles don't put food on the table. Principles don't keep a roof over your children's heads. And unfortunately, I had family at home that were, for want of a better term, economic hostages. And now it's gotten to the point where it's been killing me inside the print that my trust and my faith in my leaders had been abused so badly. And a lot of this was brought up because I had found a clip of, when Ray McGovern confronted Donald Rumsfeld on the weapons of mass destruction issue, and Rumsfeld asked McGovern, you know, flippantly, why do you think the soldiers were wearing their chemical protective gear? And McGovern said, well, it was because you told them that there were weapons of mass destruction. And not all of us believed it. There were about a half dozen of us, at least, in my company that knew about it. But the reason why we wore the stuff is because we were ordered to. And soldiers obey their orders. It's what we do. That is why we wore our chemical protective gear. And as soon as the war part was over and we were in the occupation, we knew immediately that Saddam could not have had weapons of mass destruction, because he was definitely the kind of guy who would have used them on us if he had had them. I mean, after all, he had used them on the Kurds when they were suspected of being, of assisting the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war, and he had went ahead and used chemical weapons on a city that had until recently been, at that point, had been held by the Iranians, and had a large populace that were openly against him. And if he was willing to use it within his own borders on a dissident group and upon, you know, what he thought was an external invader at the time in there, because he thought the Iranians might have still been in there, then he definitely would have used it on us. And, you know, I mean, fuck, it was the best weapons he would have had against us, the most effective means he would have had to stop the invasion. And the fact that he didn't use them was pretty much an indicator to us that he probably didn't have them. And so now, knowing what I knew then and knowing what I know now, I cannot in good conscience continue to serve in the army I love. I have 10 years of active duty time now, halfway to retirement, and I am going to have to just walk away from it. Because until there is something, some change that restores the honor and dignity of the U.S. Armed Forces, I cannot be a part of it. I am now a war criminal for having participated in this, and it tears me apart knowing that. My grandfathers both fought in World War II against persons who had committed crimes against peace, participated in illegal invasions, justified them by claiming preemption, and I feel that in a very real way I have betrayed the honor of their memories by doing this, and I will not do it anymore.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31, and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of us all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
Hey, Godless Kinzer, this is your fan Shelley in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I sure wish you put out a Watch It Burn podcast more often, because my husband and I both like to listen to them. He even listens to them at work. So here's our question for you, if you could be so kind as to answer it in one of your podcasts. We want to know what you think of the claim by Prep that he made today, it's September 2nd, that Iraq is not in a civil war at all. Is that true from what you've observed or from what you've heard? So keep up the good work and stay safe. Bye.
All right. Is there a civil war going on over here? Well, what do you call it when you have two significant factions of a population that together comprise probably about 80% of the population, who are in armed conflict with one another for control of their nation? Now, I don't know what else, how else you would define a civil war. Just because one faction has not declared itself a separate government as well does not mean that it's not a civil war. There's no, you know, there's no roundheads, there's no Johnny Reb, but it doesn't make, but it doesn't matter. It's a fucking civil war by just about any fucking definition of it. And we are to blame for the breakdown of control and for the breakdown of this society, this civilization, in this part of the world that is the birthplace of civilization. Last time we were here, I had to give a class on the history of Iraq, and they wanted me to basically just confine myself to the 20th century, to the 21st century for the most part, because their history has been recorded since, somewhere around 3000 BC, something like that. You have to remember, this country, within its geographic boundaries, encompasses the area where previous civilizations invented writing, currency, and thus commerce, sailing, agriculture. It is the source for the story of the flood in Genesis from the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the, if not the oldest known epic tales. It is the country that learned the lesson of conservation from the deforestation of the cedar forests here that were described in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and how it began a process of desertification. This is a nation that gave the world the concept of written codes of law in the form of the Code of Hammurabi. And it's just disgusting what's been done. I mean, there is this, the ruins of Uruk, an incredible ancient city. The archaeological areas of there were paved over to make a U.S. Air Force base. Now, I'm not sure where it actually is, because I never think to look up Uruk when I am on the internet, because, oh, cripes, it's so freaking slow, the one that we have to go to now. But that's, you know, beside the point. But I would just be disgusted if I found out that the base I am on right now was built on the ruins of Uruk, because there is just so much that we can still learn from the things that we are trampling underfoot over here. It's shameful. I am, as you have all gathered by now, I am an incredible fan of history and of learning. And to think that we are paving over history, it's the closest thing I can think of as an atheist. It's the closest thing to blasphemy in my worldview. But right now, I'm going to go ahead and play a song I promised my friend, promised my shop neighbor that I would play. It's his brother's band, and the song's pretty good. His brother, I've seen some pictures of him on MySpace, and he looks like one of the guys that almost but didn't quite make the cut in the casting call for House of 1,000 Corpses. So the sound is pretty good, but unfortunately it's in mono, because I don't have stereo capability just yet for my recording. But it's called All or Nothing. The band is called Blessed Doom, B-L-E-S-S-I-D, and you can find them on MySpace. And I enjoy it. I'm going to have to take the time to get some more of their stuff and listen to them. Sounds kind of like the vocals, kind of a cross between Rob Zombie and Ogre from Skinny Puppy. That's what I thought of anyway. So first, though, a call from a fan in Alaska, which is one of my favorite states, and I think that they should really change their state motto to "Fuck you, we're huge."
Hey, Kinzer, it's Kelly from Chandler. Just calling in to say I really miss your show and look forward to your next one. You have a big fan here, and I share your podcast with everyone within my immediate area, and everyone loves it. So keep it up, keep the good work, get back home safe. Take care. Bye.
Yeah.
Kinzer. It is Kelly from Chandler again. And this is not necessarily for broadcast, but I figured I would take advantage and just let you know, to let your wife know that her blog rocks, and I read that more than I read yours. Well, because you don't write as often as you should, but and that's reasonable. There's no complaints here, but just let Morgana know. I read that, and I think she rocks, and I would comment, but I'm not a member of Blogger, and I understand why she requires that. So anyway, if I see you both sometime in the near future, I'll buy you both a beer. Best to you. Get home safe. Bye.
Hey, Godless. This is David. I'm a podcaster of yours from the Los Angeles region, actually Santa Ana. But want to just hopefully get some type of response you put up on your blog, find out what's going on with your show. Haven't heard anything. I know it's last show you gave was going to be you, like I mentioned, it wasn't possibly going to come back on again, but I'm guessing that's probably true. And I just wanted to let you know, I thought you did a great job with your show. Hopefully there'll be another show soon, but if not, I think you should be proud of what you did. And also, since I'm a big fan of the Mark Maron show, I'm pretty sure you've heard that last show is going to be on the 14th. And hopefully, if you get a chance, get a moment to put your thoughts up on the blog, because I know a lot of us like to hear what you think, too. But I'll talk to you later, and just good luck. Come home safe. Bye.
Please excuse the background noise, folks. There's a ceremony going on outside my door as our unit changes over, hands over responsibility to the next unit coming in. Right now is actually the rehearsal. But anyway, moving on. I just listened to the newest podcast at documentally.com, my buddy Christian over there, another member of our Progressive Podcast Network, which you can find at newmediarevolution.org, or you can go for just his to documentally.com. And he's put together a podcast of all, it's all protest music. And though most of it's not my usual style, I was pleasantly surprised to find out that I would say probably around 70-80% of what he had on there I had already had on my old MP3 player that crapped on me. But one artist in particular that he had on there, I don't know how she pronounces her first name, if it's Kimya, Kimaya, but Kimaya, Kimya Dawson, there was a song on there that was really good. I really enjoy her work. I have a great deal of respect for her work and what she's doing, but it reminded me of a song of hers that I had initially meant to use when I was going to talk about Hurricane Katrina. And I was digging through my files here, and I do have only, I have a small clip from it that I had prepared, and so I'm going to play that now. But it was actually about the events of the Indonesian tsunami, and it was a very horrible prelude to what happened in New Orleans, and I will use that as a lead-in to my discussion of my feelings and what was going through my mind at the time of the events in New Orleans immediately after Hurricane Katrina.
You can call me crazy, but it seems to me we could have sent more than we spend in one day killing Iraqis to help the hundreds of thousands who are injured and diseased and hungry and homeless and without families. I'm appalled by our government's initial reaction and the fact that they asked for a verbal retraction from the folks who called them stingy. They're just covering their assets while they thank their greedy God for wiping out the lower class. And everything she's ever known is gone, gone, gone. Everyone she's ever loved is gone, gone, gone. The only reason she's alive, she grabbed a palm frond and held on. And held on.
In September of last year, as my unit was making preparations to come over here, I was taking a break, standing behind our hangar looking out across our flight line, as I was listening to a podcast of the Randy Rhoads Show, because we did not have an Air America affiliate there in the Clarksville area. And I listened to survivors in New Orleans describing the things that they were seeing. And as I heard them talking about bodies, specifically bodies of babies floating in the water, I looked out across our flight line, and I saw enough aircraft on our side and on the Air Force side to pull out over 1,000 people in one lift. And we were less than a half a day's flight away from New Orleans. The previous day, we had been putting tents into storage that we knew we were not going to need when we got here. Our aircraft could have been down there in less than half a day, helping pull people off of rooftops, or dropping food on the rooftops that we couldn't get people out of at the moment. Even our small observation helicopters could have carried a case of MREs and a jug of water to drop on a rooftop until a larger helicopter could arrive to evacuate survivors. And, you know, they could have said, well, there'd be too many aircraft down there, there'd be too much traffic congestion, but we could have been on standby. We could have had relief crews, so we could have been running nonstop, as many aircraft as we could safely fit in the air. More aircraft means more standby birds. In case something happens to one, another one can take off, while me and my buddies in the maintenance side of the house could be fixing that one that went down, that was down for maintenance. And yet, we were not even put on standby, not even given any kind of warning order or advisory that we might be going. Instead, we were told preparations would go on as normal for deployment to Iraq. And my wife can tell you that I cried like a baby, openly thinking of that. Thinking that it was more important for us to come here to help kill Iraqis than it was for us to help save the lives of our fellow Americans. And that is one more thing that I do not want to be a part of anymore. And I will never forget Hurricane Katrina because of our government's inaction and apathy, complete disregard for the lives of my fellow Americans, people I have sworn to protect.
5 damn days, 5 long days, and at the end of the 5th, he walking in like, hey, chilling on his vacation, sitting patiently. Them black folks gotta hope, gotta wait and see if FEMA really comes through in an emergency. But nobody seems to have a sense of urgency. Now the mayor's been reduced to crying, and guess what said, niggas been used to dying. He said, I know it looks bad, just have to wait. But getting folks are too broke to evacuate. Niggas starving and they dying of thirst. I bet he had to go and check on them refineries.
Hey, this is Chris from Fantania. I was curious, Kenzer, to know what you think about the embassy attack in Syria. If you put that in the next podcast, I'd appreciate it. Take care of yourself, bro. Come home in one piece.
The embassy attack in Syria. Well, of course shit like that's going to happen because our government has a policy of making enemies everywhere they can so that they can justify perpetual war, and therefore in a state of perpetual war they can continue to encroach on civil liberties and exert more and more control upon the populace. And as far as I've heard some people saying, well, the Syrians, you know, they fought back, it's amazing, you know, they acted to defend our embassy. Well, they're not stupid. Okay, as much saber-rattling as fucking the boy who would be king has been fucking doing against Syria and Iran, the last thing they want is him having any kind of excuse that is not actually made up in order to attack them. And so, of course, they would, you know, act to defend our embassy. I mean, well, shit, for one thing, it's just, it's their law enforcement officials and, you know, their anti-terrorist task forces and whatever they have. It's their responsibility because, you know, it was an attack within their borders. And a group like that that would conduct an attack like that might end up attacking, you know, people they actually like. So, of course, they're going to act against them. And that just points to the fact that, like I said, we have a government that has a policy of just creating enemies wherever they can.
Hey, guys, this is David calling from L.A. Big fan of the show. Just wanted to get out there and show my support for you. As soon as it's up, of course, I'm going to be downloading it instantly. I'm a subscriber. And just let the higher-ups know that all all of us here at home are rooting for you, hoping you come home safe, and waiting to hear what you have to say next. Take care, buddy. Bye.
Hey, Kinzer, this is Brian in New Hampshire. Thank you for being the only voice coming out of Iraq that I know I could trust. I'll see you stateside.
Hi, this is Tim. I live in Michigan, near a city called Ypsilanti. I just want to say, Godless Kinzer, I love every one of your podcasts, and, well, frankly, I hope to hear more from you, and I look forward to each one. Keep up the good work, man.
And this is Mommy Dearest. It's awesome to hear your voice. Keep your head down. Love you. Bye.
Hey, honey, it's me. I love you very, very much. I'm thinking of you, and I can't wait till you come home, and I'm really proud of you, and you're my hero. I know you don't really want to hear that, but I love you just the same, okay, sweetie? So, I love you, sweetie. Bye.
I had originally intended for this final podcast to be a bit more lighthearted. I had wanted to have a little fun in marking the closing of this chapter of my now moderately public life. I had a few silly little sound clips ready to use, like this one for Donald Rumsfeld.
It's like your channel's dead crazy people.
And this one for Dick Cheney.
Fear. Fear is my ally.
On further reflection, however, I felt the times we now live in are far too serious to trivialize it in such a manner. Well, actually, I guess I just had something to get off my chest. So, in closing, I would just like to thank everyone out there who has been so supportive these past few months. Thanks for the donations, thank you for the care packages, and most especially, thank you for listening and spreading the word. I've been pleased to see mentions of this show or my blog in the Wall Street Journal and on Daily Kos. I've been thrilled to have been interviewed by email by Christian Parenti. I have been approached by the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer to do an interview with them as part of a segment on mill bloggers, but it was preempted by the events of Hurricane Katrina. I was also just recently approached via email to do an email interview with C-SPAN, which would have rocked, because I'm a big SPAN fan. But unfortunately, the timing on that didn't work out very well. They emailed me like 2 days before the show was going to happen, and I managed to get to my email the day the show went on. I've been ecstatic about the encouragement and promotion I've received from my primary inspiration, Dave Rabbit. I also owe a great deal to the others who have been the sources for my information and showing me the urgency with which my mission must be carried out. Some, though not all, these wonderful workers for truth, peace, and justice are Tom Hartman, Mark Maron and Jim Earle, Rachel Maddow, Mark Riley, Mike Malloy, Randy Rhodes, Bob Kincaid, Sam Cedar and Janine Garofalo, Robert Kennedy Jr. and Mike Papantonio, Peter Werby, and especially every single member of the Progressive Podcast Network. My most heartfelt gratitude goes, of course, to you, my listeners. Without you, this wouldn't have lasted more than an episode or three, and I would still be a very bitter man, plagued by hopelessness and doubt for our eventual victory over the forces which conspire to deprive us all of our sacred liberty. I know now that enough of us know the truth and see the paths of history that are being retraced, that disaster can be averted if we just have the resolve, the passion, and the commitment to risk all for what we know is right. So, until the next incarnation of this modest effort to save the world, take care of each other and watch your six. This is Brian David Kinzer, LSA Anaconda, Iraq, September 2006. My closing music is for Brian Brewster, Dilawar, the victims of September 11, 2001, and Hurricane Katrina, the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, the people of Israel and Gaza and Lebanon, all soldiers and resistance fighters of the world, and all of the other nameless and countless victims of the greed of evil men.